the curriculum, the faculty setting fires to our butts and all that kind of stuff, which is wonderful. But what about the mindset? What about the approach? How do we integrate that? And to talk about that, also from San Jose, is Kathleen Rowe and Ed Mamory.
Thank you, Karen. Good morning, everyone. We're really delighted to follow our colleagues talking about the distance program. We're now going to put this in the perspective of our entire university and our department. Ed, can you just enter, maybe? So we do have the disclosure statement that we were told to put in, so now we can move along. I'm going to do the context, and then Ed will talk about some of the specific ways in which we center inclusion in our department, and then I'll come back and talk about a couple of tensions. I wanted to take a minute to talk about the context within which we approach diversity at our university. Not only is our state extraordinarily diverse, and the San Francisco Bay Area, especially the South Bay, always diverse and dynamic and changing, but our university itself was founded with a diverse center at its very core. And I don't think that our university embraced or understood the historic nature of its commitment to diversity. That's something that in my 20 years there is a fairly recent reclaiming. This is a picture of the women from Men's Normal School in 1857, which was our founding. And our university, we all just kind of re-remembered at our 150th anniversary last year, was that our university was founded to deal with the multicultural communities that had come up through the gold rush in California. People came from all over the world to California seeking gold. Some ended up staying, and by the 1850s, there were lots of children from different ethnic and racial and international backgrounds in California, and there weren't enough teachers to deal with them and their diverse needs. And so our university was founded to deal with the multicultural needs of children in the California region due to the gold rush. Our programs, just to give you a set of a little bit of the context, we're going to be talking about our MPH program, but for any of you that do MPH programs know that they, outside of schools of public health, know that they only survive on the foundation of a rich and diverse and dynamic undergraduate program, and so that's the structure of our department. Our own history at San Jose State is also something that I wanted to talk about, our contemporary history, because, again, it's only in the last 20 years that we have really reclaimed who we are, the land on which we sit, and the important things that have happened as a result of the place that we are. And these are just a couple of the pictures. On to the right is our beautiful new Cesar Chavez Arch. The farm workers movement began largely in San Jose. Cesar Chavez lived just a few blocks from campus, and a lot of the early organizing work was done on our campus. Also, we are so proud of the 1968 Olympic athletes that raised their fists when they were on the gold and bronze medal podium. They were San Jose's, two of them were San Jose State students, and about 6 years ago, the students at San Jose decided that it was completely inappropriate and wrong that our campus didn't have any public art recognizing these people, and so the students of San Jose State raised the money for these extraordinary statues recognizing our athletes. And at the top, another thing that's relatively recent for us to understand and reclaim is that one of our most famous and most used PE buildings was actually the site of a place where people were, when they were being interred during World War II, Japanese Americans were brought to our campus and processed there before they were sent off to internment camps. And so understanding our campus and our history and our relationship to diversity and all of its complexity is really important in our context. So we have a couple of really strong core commitments that have always been an explicit and articulated part of our department. First is the application of very practical applications of the social ecologic framework. We've always been community-based, but I think only in the last 10 or 15 years have we really understood community building within our department and within our programs as a core pedagogical strategy. And because we have diverse students in our department and in our MPH program, that community building is complicated, it's complex, it's not natural, it's not easy, and it's absolutely central to us reaching our learning outcomes. And our understanding of diversity has changed also in recent years. In the 1970s, I've been at San Jose 20 years, and in the 1970s, because we're a public institution and a regional institution, our diversity has always reflected who lives in the San Jose area. In the 1970s, who lived in San Jose were white people, Latinos from Mexico, largely from Mexico, or from the region for many generations, and small African American population. In the 1980s, added to that became Southeast Asians, not only Vietnamese, but also at our university, the first generations of Cambodian and Hmong students going to college, and also Iranians. In the 1990s, added to that were South Asians coming to work in Silicon Valley in the tech industry, Afghanis and Iraqis. And then since 2000, we have seen now more movement into the university because more people are coming into the Bay Area from various African countries, both Eastern and West Coast, and also Central Americans. And so all of those people are in our undergraduate program, and all of those people are in our MPH program. And we've also come to understand diversity because of who we are as a faculty in even bigger ways. So this is diversity unplugged or diversity squared. We understand diversity to also include and embrace LGBT populations, people of various religions. This is a higher ed in general post-2001 recognition that that the diversity of religious and faith perspectives is a critical part of diversity, political views, country of origin, disability, all of that. And our evolution in understanding diversity has very much mirrored, I think, the AACNU, American Association of University and Colleges, growing understanding of diversity and centering of diversity in the middle, in the heart of higher education. We've moved from recognizing diversity to expecting diversity, from dealing with diversity to centering it right at the heart of what we do, from understanding diversity as the status quo and access to really seeking diversity. And Ed will talk about some of the things that we do to bring in a diverse group and maintain and graduate a diverse group, even in the midst of incredible diversity in our region. And we've become a critical part of the AACNU Inclusive Excellence Initiative. And last year we did a presentation on this. I have become increasingly involved with this at the AACNU level. This is the policy statement from AACNU about diversity, and that diversity is inclusive excellence is the active, intentional, and ongoing engagement with difference as part of higher education. And in our department, we have embraced this also because it is so central to eliminating disparities. And so now I'll turn it over to Ed, who will talk about policy, organizational, and curricular commitments and how we operationalize this commitment throughout all aspects of our department and our MPH program.
Good morning. I also want to highlight that we are a very small program, and so the commitment to diversity is pretty extraordinary considering the constraints of a really small budget, a really small faculty, and really a vibrant student population, so we really want to maintain that. So the policy commitments, the faculty and student diversity, the commitment to that is typical to all universities, being really thoughtful about the specific outreach of how you ensure diverse faculty and student populations within what is doable. Things that may not be typical at other universities is our faculty's commitment to respond to all accounts of exclusion. Students feel, because of this very specific policy of coming to the MPH program director and then actually following all the other required steps up to the chair or whatever, students feel fairly safe in being able to do that, and great things come out of that. And so some of the things that Dan Perales has actually already have shown you around sexual diversity, for example, have come out of student concerns with the program and our self-critical examination of what needs to happen. We are really proactive to advance inclusive excellence through leadership. So faculty proactively take leadership roles where we see intersection of where a policy change needs to happen. So for example, the Committee to Enhance Equity and Diversity, faculty always stand on that committee. The Campus Climate Survey is a university level that looks at how comfortable is the campus climate for students. And then we also participate in our very small department in university strategic planning. Also, a commitment to diverse workforce development, the minority training program, and cancer control is geared for, and it's a California state initiative through UCSF and UCLA, to actually increase the number of underrepresented minority doctoral students. We have our small program. I think we've passed 40 students who have participated in internships that actually really promote that. I'm a member of the National Board of Public Health Examiners, and I sit on the diversity subcommittee. And then you'll hear more about the celebration policy. We do lots of celebration. Organizational commitments include a diversity statement, and that was one of the things I was really referring to, where students came to us and basically said, you know, as a program, you kind of talk it, but what are you really doing around sexual diversity? So as a result, we will be having our 11th annual sexual diversity workshop. And the diversity statement, I kind of skipped because it's actually connected. We have a diversity statement also created by students that really have served us well in our recruitment materials. It's in our admissions. We're now working on a college-level diversity statement, and we find that students really appreciate knowing what when they do shopping for their graduate education. And then also National Health Disparity Service Learning Collaborative. As a small department with a small budget, we actually dedicate dollars to be able to participate in that. And then we have a Oaxaca project, which is not really a formal part of our curriculum, but students go to Oaxaca and faculty, and they go once a year, and there's a cultural exchange, and then people from Oaxaca come, and it involves around local issues and organizing. Curricular developments, we, since 1991, and again being a small program, it's difficult to have one course dedicated to a core area of CIF competencies and that sort of thing, but we're committed to having a whole course in multicultural communication. We interweave concepts of diversity, cultural humility, privilege, concepts of allies throughout our curriculum. Writing is a really important part of students read, and then also have many opportunities to create through creative writing to express their thoughts and their views and their opinions. In the beginning of the program, they write a mission statement, and then at the end of their program in leadership, they share their commitments upon graduation. Artifacts, here you see a picture. Artifacts are actually things that are that symbolize their experience in the MPH program, and often it's the diversity component that really, really is showcased there. This is a picture of a cultural table and multicultural communication where students, each student has an opportunity to talk about their history and their background. And then convocation, even celebrating diversity at convocation. I don't know, I think like 13 languages, 17 last convocation, that represents students' languages of when they grew up and or are currently using, and really celebrating their families. Their families actually escort them on stage, and that's a really big celebration. And I'll turn it over to Kathleen Rowe.
So that's what Ed has just highlighted are ways in which we consciously and consistently try to make sure that diversity is the center of what we're doing from the policy level, organizational, and curriculum. One of the things that we've noticed is that the faculty, we're a group of five that are the full-time faculty, and we've come up together, we've been together for anywhere from 10 to 19 years, and we think and believe in a very synergistic and similar way. But we've begun to notice that much of what we believe in is not codified in the official formal documents of our university. And since we're all becoming sort of an age to start thinking about the time in which we will no longer be here, we realize that if we were to go tomorrow, our program could be implemented meeting all of our written documents and have no direct way of addressing diversity at all. And so what we'll be experimenting with in the next couple of years is how do you write this into the living documents, the governance documents, the constitution, the student organization bylaws, all of the curriculum and course outlines to make sure that we can be replaced, that we will be replaced, but that this lifelong commitment we've had to centering inclusion will be something that's expected and maintained and further developed as new people take on. So I'd like to conclude with three tensions that we've found. Some of them are specific to a public university on a ridiculous state budget that is increasingly cut and cut and cut to the bare bones, but also some are tensions in the nature of higher education and what we're trying to do. So the first one is that we as an MPH program are completely, or as a department, are completely dependent on the commitment to a diverse pipeline that the doctoral granting institutions have and maintain. We have to hire doctorally prepared faculty, and we want to have a diverse faculty, but we can't grant doctoral degrees. And so the pool of eligible people who will come to us is completely dependent on the diversity commitments of the doctoral granting institutions. And in my own case, I've seen the local university that used to provide us with such extraordinary extraordinary people coming through with such broad range of backgrounds shift its perspective and shift its emphasis. And the pool of people coming out of that university to serve us and to come into our institution has really shrunk. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't fantastic people in there and fantastic people coming out, but it's different than it was 20 years ago, and that makes it very hard for us to find diverse faculty who will come and teach at our university, and we can't continue this commitment unless there are people behind us in the pipeline. Our response has been to take extraordinary risks in our searching and recruiting. Right now, we have two open positions, and in our department, two open faculty tenure track positions. But here's an example of what we have to do. We're under extreme pressure from CEEF, from our accrediting agency, to show increased base resources by the end of this year. We are desperately seeking assistance from everybody above us in the university to give us, and if those of you in higher education know, to give us new base. What are the chances of that? But at the same time that we're politicking and convincing and begging for that, we also have to go to our dean and ask for a whole bunch more recruitment dollars, because there aren't that many people applying from the local area, diverse people to applying to our positions in our local area. We've got to bring people in from New York, from Atlanta, from Florida, and we don't have the money to do that on a tiny budget. So we have to take risks. Are we going to risk our accreditation request? Are we going to risk our recruitment request? And this is complicated, and the kind of thing that we have to do in a small department on a small budget to make this commitment to faculty diversity. So one of our solutions has been to grow our own as best we possibly can to grow our own. We have a wonderful program in California. The CSU system, the California State University system, has a forgivable loan in which students who go on to doctoral degrees and promise to come back and teach in the CSU system have all of their expenses paid at the university of their choice, at the doctoral institution. We've sponsored 5 people for forgivable loans. One became too ill with HIV to continue in our first one, but we're currently sponsoring 2, and we've sponsored another 2, and one has come back and is teaching with us, and I'm hoping that one of the ones that we're sponsoring now will come back and replace me in the department. We also have pre-doctoral fellowships that are possible through our university system. And we sponsored 3 people in the master's program to look into doctoral programs through the pre-doctoral fellowship. Another tension, this is very complicated for us and probably for any of you, is that if you're CEEF accredited, we respect and we appreciate the curricular nudge and requirements of accreditation. We have a 42-unit program. We must meet the graduate level competencies that are endorsed by the profession of health education. We must also meet the instruction in 5 core areas. And very soon we'll have to meet the public health competencies of the public health exam. So we've got an extraordinarily and increasingly competency-dense curriculum that we must deliver within our MPH program. It leaves very little room to add additional things. We can't have many electives. We can't have too many extra things in the courses. So what happens to diversity? Does that become an extra thing that gets added on, or do we interweave it into every single thing we're doing? But how do we do that and also make sure that our students are addressing and mastering the competencies? And so the way that we've tried to respond to that is to add diversity to our program outcomes. In addition to the standard program outcomes, we have In addition to the standard program outcomes, we have also added and insist upon having our diversity-related outcomes and also in our essential objectives. And the last one is, I don't know why California is talking about butts so much this morning, but some of you in enrollment-mandated universities might understand this. Certainly everybody in the CSU understands it. Look at this tension for a minute. We are required to meet a target enrollment in our department every single semester, and the consequences for missing enrollment by even one FTES are immediate, and they affect our budget, our clerical support, and part-time faculty positions. One semester, you go under target. The target is set by I know who sets it, but it's a ridiculous formula. So we are required that every faculty member must be teaching the equivalent of 150 students, 150 butts in seats every semester. And so that means that our enrollment strategies are just bring them in. Just bring them in, whoever they are, just bring them in and teach them. The retention and graduation commitments of the university are increasingly related to specific demographic groups. So there's a disconnect between this mass, just bring people in, and then, but nurture, retain, and graduate specific groups of people. So if I was thinking about how to bring in, retain, and graduate underrepresented groups, I wouldn't say bring in as many people as you possibly can, fill up the class as big as you possibly can, and move everybody through. I'd say stop, think, analyze your environment, be very specific in how you're recruiting, what you do to bring people in, how you nurture them here, and how you move them out. And we have this complete disconnect, and both mandates are essential and required. So in our MPH program, where we have control, because we have a smaller cohort we can work with, we're trying really hard to align the recruitment, outreach, enrollment, retention, and graduation strategies. But we can't do that in the undergraduate program, and that's a challenge. Last one. Yeah. And so our conclusion is that it's a process. It's a 150-year process on our campus. It's a 20-year process within our lifetimes, and we really look forward to turning this over to the new generation of faculty who will continue the process. Thanks again.
Great. Thank you. Kathy, could everybody just stay up here? Because the mic doesn't move. And so I'm going to have them move. I mean, literally, if you get asked a question, you're going to have to come to the podium. All right, so if you want to just stand up and pretend we're having our picture taken, whatever it is you want to do, just to make it easier. So, what kinds of questions do we have? Yes, in the back.
I have a question for you folks about the education program.
You know, what I have found is happening is that people kind of self-select and that those who are into using internet phone and are comfortable with that are much more likely. There's about half a dozen people who show up if I do this three or four times a year each time. And it's really been really no difficulty. And I think that people who don't know the technology, just don't do it. It's a real challenge. How do we set up tutorial? It's really hard. The other thing that we try to do is have a few minutes beforehand where Frank's available to have him do a sound check and a microphone check and then be able to be online with me.
I think the other element is not to make the assumption that they don't know. There are so many conference calls happening nowadays. There's so many one-way broadcasts, webcasts, that once you send the Illuminate link and you pre-warn folks that you have to have a system that's going to open up an application to download, even if all of their technology is not working, the most important component becomes the speaker, so they can hear the presentation. They can always chat in. So folks are doing it at work with their headphones on. They may not be using a microphone. And then the other piece about the Illuminate that works as a marketing tool is it's recordable. So if they can't do it in the moment, they can come back a week later at home at night and play it at home. So we can't make the assumption. There's, you know, every month now there's a webcast for almost every health issue. So people are used to that.
Yeah, of course, we don't rely on Illuminate alone. We also do, for those in the California area, I make visits to various communities and hold meetings there.
Okay, question. Yes, ma'am. So is there a conflict? I just realized that the machine doesn't know.
And are we missing something? I mean,
by not having a thesis at the master's degree level of distance learning.
The requirement is that they have a culminating experience. And actually the policy is not so different from our campus. It's really unrealistic for a student on campus in 2 years to do a thesis. So it's actually really consistent with that. It's really the nature of the fast-paced two-year program. So CEEF just requires culminating experience. Oh, and then in the campus, they do have the opportunities for thesis and project. Okay. And then,
well,
actually, you don't have to have that, but there are other opportunities within their field for an interest in research than opportunities within their field work. And so we're pretty sensitive to that. There are other opportunities within that two-year program that we try our best to give
now
them those opportunities.
To the appropriate retention and recruitment. If you get somebody who's planning on a doctorate in epidemiology or research, having that conversation and not being wedded to, I need the button C, saying, this might not be, the distance program for us might not be your best fit if this is your end result. You want something published. Maybe you look at a campus-based program. So this is where you have to actually take that tension and say, ooh, I want retention, I want these people in, but if you're not a good fit, don't waste your money.
Excellent. Other questions? Yes, sir, please.
So I think you're asking if what you would like our data stratified not only by ethnicity but also by gender.
Yep.
So our differences were balanced by gender. Our differences in our 452 have not differed at all by gender, nor had they differed like within Latinos of foreign born and U.S. born. Most everybody reaches about the 80% graduation from a four-year college, and about half of those. In fact, half of our students who have had a C average have gone on to medical school or graduate school of the college graduates. Is that what you were getting at?
Well, actually I was thinking in terms of the people that were not in the program.
Who are not accepted, who apply, who are not accepted? Yes, and I think
that in your program, if the men were about equally represented as the women, then the difference there is even more strong.
Yes, you're right. And then there are trends over the last 20 years and who goes on to college. So our students are all very low income, so they get substantial scholarship support, although less and less over the years. About 60 to 70% go to the UCs. Mostly they get into UCLA, Berkeley, and UC San Diego. So they're going to the top UCs. How they get in, I'm still a little mystified, but then they're really taught to seize the day and make use of resources, and so they don't do as well in their initial years, but then they catch up because they're still behind academically. The other part of your question was where they go. 11% end up going to Stanford, but our students were not really aimed at getting the academically prepared students to go on to Stanford. Increasingly over the years, more and more students have gone to state universities, and now more and more are going to community colleges. I would say in the beginning years, I counseled students, I mean, it's 20 years ago, not to really go to a community college because of the quality of students that's increased so much at the state universities and community colleges and what you can save in tuition and then transfer from especially a community college into a top university. Increasingly, probably 20% of our students do that, and I think more and more will, and I think that they get a great break in their undergraduate debt by doing that. But most come out pretty debt-free undergraduate.
Thank you. Other questions? Yes, please.
To produce the online courses? I'm not following.
How many staff do you have to help the faculty build their online courses?
That would be
him. That's him.
That would be him part-time.
That's it. And he does a great job. And it's a half-time position at best for Frank. So it's been a learning curve for all of us.
And so far he's trained what?
Eight of us, and I'm of course fully supporting the students too.
Which really is about feeding back to motivation. If I have a faculty member who's doing it because they've been told it doesn't work. If they're excited, they're nervous, they're a challenge, they'll go that way.
Let me add though that there is the IES, the International Extended Studies that we're based in, does have its own staff that provides support But Frank is our primary, they set up our courses, and Frank is the person who provides the hands-on TA for us. Well, I kind of alluded to that. We received a planning grant in which we are able to pay faculty to learn in the very beginning. So everyone was given some stipends to be able to sit down and go through with IES and later on with Frank to learn how to do this, because it was a tremendous paradigm shift for all of us to transfer from a traditional class-based approach to this very unique approach to distance learning.
Other questions? I have one for Janie, which is, what's been the response to the health education profession of having a 2-year health education degree? Are they prepared for certification? I'm sure you get questions.
We are not training 2-year health educators. They're not going to meet all the bachelor's level competencies. But we are looking at, what we did was we looked at what the jobs that were kind of entry level public health-ish jobs in community-based organizations or health departments in our area. And there were jobs that required an AS degree. And we had students who were getting certificates, and sometimes 2 certificates, sometimes 3 certificates, sometimes 4 certificates, and they still don't have an AS degree. And so we wanted to make sure that we were offering that option for those who aren't, for whatever reason. We also want to make sure they transfer if that's in their future, and make that less scary and more possible and more affordable. But that was why we developed an AS degree, is because there were people who were completing or were close to completing an associate's degree, and we were seeing there were jobs where having an associate's degree was a hiring benefit to them, whether it's as a community organizer at, you know, a girls' academy, or whether it's, which is a low-income project, or whether it's working in a community clinic. That's what we had the AS degree in health education for. It's still, I would say, that's still emerging, and I still think that for being a health educator, bachelor's level is entry.
Right. Terrific. And just one last thing. Adam, I know that you just said that this was an exploratory pilot kind of study. Are you going to follow through on this and see where else you can go with this? This will just be our last question.
Okay. Yes, thank you for that question. Actually, if you're interested in this topic, there was a variation of this research project that's published coming out in the February issue of a journal called Explore, the Journal of Science and Discovery, a really quite wonderful journal by Elsevier Publishing Company. So I'd be happy to give you the reference for that if you're interested.
Okay, real quick, if you're interested in knowing more about our program, we're in booth 641 in Exhibit Hall. And we have brochures up here.
All right, thank you all for coming. If you let's thank our presenters one more time. And if you would like, if you're doing the half hour as they're working their way out and you want to ask a couple of quick questions, I'm sure they would be delighted. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. You got it.
Yeah. Oh, aren't you sweet?
Tommy was so determined to make sure that I got your card and I knew Oh,